August 4th, 1984, Fort Myers, Florida. 20-year-old Carol Wolzencroft fails to show up for her shift at her workplace and is never heard from again. 3 days later, Carol's parents return home from vacation and discover her car parked outside the residence, as well as a note from Carol's boyfriend, Eugene LeFay Jr., who claims she has gone missing without explanation. Due to their troubled relationship, there is evidence to suggest that Eugene was responsible for Carol's disappearance, but even though he eventually goes to prison for another murder, he never admits any involvement, and no trace of Carol is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we've got an unsolved missing persons case to cover today. The 1984 disappearance of Carol Wolzencroft. And what makes this week's episode particularly unique is that the missing victim is the relative of a fellow true crime podcaster. You might be familiar with Going West True Crime, a podcast which is hosted by a couple named Heath and Daphne. They've been around for just over 2 years now and released episodes about a number of cases, both solved and unsolved, and some of these cases have also been featured on The Trail Went Cold. Well, they recently passed the milestone of releasing their 100th episode, and it was a pretty important one because it covered the disappearance of Carol Wolzencroft, who happens to be Daphne's paternal aunt. Shortly thereafter, Daphne started reaching out to other true crime podcasts to see if they would feature her aunt's case, so I decided to help out and put together an episode. Even though Daphne was not even born at the time her aunt went missing, Carol's disappearance still haunts their family. Right from the outset, suspicion turned towards Carol's boyfriend, Eugene LeFay Jr., who was known for being abusive and having a violent temper, and Carol was reportedly planning to break up with him on the same day she disappeared. Without Carol's body, there was just not enough evidence to make an arrest, but Eugene would have a number of run-ins with the law until he finally wound up in prison for a different murder. After more than 3 decades, Carol continues to remain a missing person, so we're going to try and spread awareness about her story on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Carol Wolzencroft. Our story begins in Florida in 1984, and our central figure is 20-year-old Carol Wolzencroft. Carol was originally born in Buffalo, New York, and spent her early years living in the town of Kenmore before her parents, Ed and Ann Wolzencroft, moved the family to Florida when Carol was 8 years old. Carol also had an older sister named Lori, whom, as you might have guessed, happens to be Daphne's mother, and Lori would move to California. At this point, Carol is living in a rental house in Fort Myers alongside her 24-year-old boyfriend, Eugene LeFay Jr., and is employed as a server at Raffles Bar & Grill, which is located in the Edison Mall. On the evening of August 4th, Carol was scheduled to show up for her shift at 4:45 p.m., but she never arrived and did not call in to let them know she wouldn't be there. At the time, Ed and Ann Wolsencroft were living in the nearby city of Cape Coral, but had left in their camper trailer on an extended vacation to visit friends in Boulder, Colorado. In fact, 4 years earlier, Ed and Ann had moved with Carol to Boulder and lived there for a year before they ultimately decided to return to Florida. When they arrived home from their vacation on August the 7th, the Wolsencrofts were surprised to find Carol's car, a rust-colored 1981 Mazda GLC hatchback, parked in their driveway with the keys in the ignition. The front door of their house was unlocked, and Carol was not there, but they did find an unusual note in the kitchen written by Eugene LeFay. It read, quote, "Carol has left, and I don't know where she is. See me as soon as you get home," end quote. When Ed and Ann went to Carol's house to speak with Eugene, he seemed very emotional and told them that he last saw Carol at around noon on August the 4th while she was preparing to take a shower. Eugene said that he then left to visit relatives in the nearby community of Lehigh Acres, but when he returned home later that day, Carol was not there, and her car, as well as most of her clothing, was missing. When Eugene traveled to her parents' residence in order to look for her, he claimed that Carol's vehicle was already parked in the driveway. Since the front door was unlocked, Eugene decided to walk in and leave the Wolsencrofts a note, asking them to get in touch with him. Well, when Ed and Ann searched Carol's rental house, they did confirm that about 80% of her clothing appeared to be missing. Carol's perfume and makeup were also gone, though oddly, her makeup mirror and her jewelry were still there. During their search, the Wolsencrofts happened to come across a gun on Eugene's dresser, and he told them that he kept it for protection. Even though Carol had been missing for 3 days at this point, Eugene had still not contacted the police, so Ed and Ann got in touch with the Lee County Sheriff's Office and officially reported her missing. Carol was incredibly close to her parents and known for being a very outgoing person with many friends, but none of them had heard from her, and it was very uncharacteristic for Carol to remain out of contact with everyone for days. In addition to missing her scheduled shift at work, Carol also missed a dental appointment she had made on August the 7th, and even though she had promised to pick up her grandmother at her home in Cape Coral and give her a ride to the airport that very same day, she never showed up. In addition, Carol had dropped off clothes at the dry cleaner, which she never bothered to pick up, she did not grab her last paycheck from work, and none of the money in her bank account was touched. Ed and Ann immediately had their suspicions about Eugene, as Carol's relationship with him was not in a good place. Carol originally met Eugene at Raffles Bar and Grill, where he was employed as a cook. They only dated for about a month before Carol decided to move out of her parents' residence and into the rental house with Eugene, which they shared with another couple. The Wolsencrofts initially thought that Eugene seemed like a nice, charming guy, but it turned out he had a volatile temper and was actually fired from his job at Raffles Bar and Grill 2 weeks before Carol went missing. Shortly after they left on their vacation and arrived at their friend's house in Boulder, Ed and Ann received a phone call from Carol, who told them she had discovered Eugene was a drug dealer. He would often bring shady people over to their house to sell them drugs, which made Carol uncomfortable, but her parents assured her that if things got really bad, she could go stay at her grandmother's house until they returned from their vacation. However, Carol was reluctant to do this, since Eugene knew where her grandmother lived, and things would get even worse when the Wolsencrofts received a letter from Carol a few days later. This time, she revealed that Eugene had been hitting her and threatening her life, but she didn't know how to leave him. In fact, the reason Carol wrote a letter to her parents, rather than phoning them, was because she did not think she would be able to make a call without Eugene finding out. This prompted Ed and Ann to write Carol back to let her know they were ending their vacation early and driving home. They said they would return on August the 7th and advised Carol to go stay at their house until they arrived. It turned out that on August the 3rd, the day before she went missing, Carol had told some of her co-workers that she was planning to break up with Eugene the following day. That same evening, Eugene showed up at Raffles Bar and Grill in the middle of Carol's shift and started an argument with her. Well, the Wolsencrofts would learn some disturbing information when they told police about the gun they saw in Eugene's dresser, and learned that he was not supposed to be carrying a firearm because he was on probation for an horrific crime. In 1980, Eugene was arrested after raping a 15-year-old girl whom he had threatened to beat with a metal club, and his assault wound up getting her pregnant. Eugene received a 3-year prison sentence, though he was released early on probation, and it seemed likely that Carol was completely unaware of his criminal history. Once Carol's disappearance made the newspapers, an eyewitness came forward and claimed that at around 4:15 p.m. on August the 4th, a half hour before Carol was scheduled to arrive at work, she pulled up alongside a vehicle under the Caloosahatchee Bridge overpass. The vehicle was described as being a rust-colored Mazda, and a woman resembling Carol was in the front passenger seat arguing with a male driver. The woman was described as looking very pale and frightened and screaming out, quote, "Take me to work, I have to get to work," as she banged her fists on her knees. The driver apparently kept trying to hide his face with his hand, but the witness described him as having a dark complexion and dark, unkempt, shoulder-length hair. When the light changed, the car cut in front of the witness and sped south on U.S. Route 41. The witness also claimed that she wrote down the car's license number, and while she lost it days later, she recalled it having a Y, and the license number for Carol's car was QYP129. While the description of the male driver did resemble Eugene, who hailed from a Puerto Rican family, but when police tried to question him, he was very uncooperative. The alibi he provided completely fell apart, because even though Eugene claimed he was visiting relatives in Lehigh Acres on the afternoon Carol went missing, they all denied having seen him that day. However, one relative who did see Eugene in Lehigh Acres later that evening was his father, Eugene LeFay Sr. When initially questioned by police, Eugene Sr. looked nervous and reluctant to talk until they assured him they could keep him safe if he had anything important to share. Eugene Sr. finally revealed that on the evening of August 4th, Eugene and his brother showed up at his residence and they both appeared to be angry and acting aggressively. Eugene went into the backyard and grabbed a shovel and told his father that he needed to borrow his car, which was a Buick Regal. Eugene Sr. then saw Eugene and his brother put what he described as a quote-unquote large object into the Regal's trunk before they drove off. They would be gone for around 4 or 5 hours before they returned the vehicle to Eugene Sr., who said that his two sons looked tired and sweaty. Eugene then watched his father's shovel before setting it on fire in the backyard, and he told Eugene Sr. not to tell anyone about what he saw. Since Eugene Sr. always kept track of the mileage in his vehicle, he noticed that there was an additional 14 miles on the odometer when the car was brought back. The case would take a bizarre turn on August the 31st when the Wolves and Cross received an anonymous phone call from a man who told them that Carol's body could be found in a remote field off Coconut Road, just outside the town of Bonita Springs. After this tip was passed on to the authorities, they performed a massive search of the area, and while they had no success at finding Carol, they received an unexpected surprise when they came across a garbage bag in a ditch containing the decomposed body of a newborn female infant. The child was wrapped in two towels and still had her umbilical cord attached, and while the medical examiner was able to determine that she had been born alive, the level of decomposition was too high to figure out her exact cause of death. Believe it or not, the Lee County Sheriff's Office was soon contacted by a man claiming to be a part-time psychic who told them he had a vision of Carol in a rural area and felt compelled to phone her parents. But he now acknowledged that he had gotten his clairvoyant images crossed, which is why the tip didn't pan out. I don't believe this psychic was ever identified, but police did not consider him to be a suspect, and ultimately concluded that the discovery of the deceased infant had no connection to Carol's case. In spite of this setback, the Wolves and Cross were so desperate for answers that they contacted a number of different psychics for assistance over the years, and also offered a $5,000 reward for information. Months later, investigators traveled to Middletown, Ohio, to recover a gun which Eugene had sold to another man shortly after Carol went missing, though it was never conclusively proven that this gun was the murder weapon. At some point, another man came forward, and claimed that he had once had a conversation with Eugene, who admitted to having killed Carol and stated, quote, "They'll never find her." By the time the one-year anniversary of Carol's disappearance arrived, investigators were hoping to re-interview Eugene, but had trouble locating him. Well, it would turn out that Eugene had left Florida and moved to New York City to live with his sister, and they would work together in order to rob and stab cab drivers for their money, which eventually led to Eugene's arrest. In 1987, Eugene was convicted on the charges of robbery and attempted robbery and served 8 years in prison. However, in October of 2006, Eugene found himself in much more serious legal trouble when he attempted to pawn off a clock radio in New York City and was arrested on the charge of burglary. The radio belonged to a 50-year-old woman named Maria Rivera, and 2 days before Eugene's arrest, the decomposing bodies of both Maria and her 9-year-old daughter, Mariah Navarro, had been found inside their respective bedrooms at their Manhattan apartment. Both victims were bludgeoned to death with a hammer, and Mariah's body was stuffed inside her bedroom closet. By this point, the victims had been dead for weeks, and were only discovered after the principal from Mariah's school requested a welfare check since she had missed 9 days. The front door was locked, and there were no signs of forced entry, and since Eugene was Maria's boyfriend and had been living in the apartment for the past 2 months, he immediately became the prime suspect. But it wasn't long before Eugene's DNA was matched at the scene of another unsolved homicide. In December of 2005, 27-year-old Cheryl Greaves was beaten and stabbed to death inside her apartment in East Harlem, and while her two young daughters, ages 1 and 3, were present when the crime took place, they were both left unharmed. In an ironic turn of events, nearly 1 year prior to her murder, Cheryl had appeared as a guest on an episode of the Maury Povich Show about marital infidelity, where she confronted her husband about cheating on her. For this reason, investigators looked at Cheryl's husband as a possible suspect, though he was quickly ruled out because of a rock-solid alibi, and DNA evidence eventually identified Eugene as the perpetrator. While Eugene was never charged with the deaths of Maria and Mariah, he agreed to a plea deal in which he received a sentence of 16 years to life for burglarizing Maria's apartment. He was subsequently convicted of Cheryl's murder and received an additional sentence of 23 years to life. One of the original detectives on Carol's case decided to visit Eugene in prison to question him about her disappearance, but Eugene reacted by spitting at him and yelling profanity before getting up and asking to leave the room. Eugene continued to languish behind bars before he passed away in December of 2016 at the age of 56. In the end, he never revealed any details about what happened to Carol Woolsencroft, and she continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, as you probably know, there are a number of true crime podcasts out there hosted by people attempting to find justice for a missing or murdered loved one. Perhaps the most notable example was the Voices for Justice podcast hosted by Sarah Turney, who was seeking answers about her missing sister Alyssa, and an arrest was finally made in that case last summer. But here, we have a true crime podcast host who has been trying to find answers about a missing relative she never even got the chance to meet, since the disappearance took place several years before she was born. In case you're not familiar with Going West True Crime, the podcast launched 2 years ago, and throughout the show's run, Daphne has often made reference to the fact that she had an aunt who went missing and was never found. In July of 2020, Daphne appeared as a guest on an episode of the podcast Missing Maura Murray in order to share Carol's story, but it was not until the end of last year, when Going West released their 100th episode, that Daphne and Heath decided to devote an entire show to this case. Even though Daphne had grown up hearing about her missing aunt, it was not until around 2016 when she started digging into the case and got in contact with one of the original detectives. At one point, Daphne considered traveling down to Florida to put together a documentary about Carol's story, and she may still do something like that in the future. However, I should mention that even though Daphne is related to the victim, she has always been denied access to the original case files because this is still technically an open investigation. So if there are certain details I've shared about the case which might seem murky and leave you with questions, Daphne likely feels the exact same way. Of course, I'll state right up front that even though this case is technically unsolved, it isn't much of a mystery. It seems pretty obvious that Eugene LeFay Jr. was responsible for Carol's disappearance, and while he ultimately went to prison for other crimes, he died without admitting his culpability. Since they can't charge the likely perpetrator with Carol's murder, the big priority for her family is to recover her remains. I've covered unsolved missing persons cases on this podcast where it seemed pretty obvious that the victim's spouse was responsible, but without a body or strong physical evidence, the authorities just could not make an arrest. In some of these cases, the suspected spouse would then go on to harm someone else at a later time, but Eugene LeFay Jr. is on a whole other level. Even though he was only charged and convicted of the murder of Cheryl Greaves, he is also believed to be responsible for killing Carol, as well as Maria Rivera and her daughter, Mariah Navarro. That's a total of four victims, which would technically make Eugene a serial killer. And as a reminder, Mariah Navarro was only 9 years old, and Eugene bludgeoned her to death with a hammer, so that gives you a pretty good idea about what an evil human being he was. Even before he met Carol, Eugene served time in prison for raping a 15-year-old, and I think it's safe to say that if Carol had known this, she never would have dated him to begin with. They had not been a couple for that long before they decided to move in together, but even though Eugene gave off the impression of being a charming guy on the surface, it wasn't long before Carol saw his true colors. When Eugene got linked to the murders in New York City years later, he was described by police as being a drug user who liked to prey on down-on-their-luck women as he started a relationship with Maria Rivera before he killed her. Even though there's virtually no chance that Carol took off voluntarily, Eugene did attempt to stage things in order to make it look that way. His story was that he left their house on the afternoon she disappeared in order to visit relatives, and when he returned later that day, she was gone, along with her car and most of her clothing. Eugene then said he went to visit her parents' house and found Carol's car parked there with her keys in the ignition, and since the front door was unlocked, he decided to go inside and leave a note for the Wollstonecrafts, informing them that Carol was missing. Well, the big issue is that Ed and Anne did not return home until August the 7th, 3 days after Eugene last saw Carol, and they said he seemed pretty emotional when they spoke to him. So the obvious question is, if Eugene was that worried, why didn't he go to the police himself and report Carol missing? I've seen this type of thing in countless missing persons cases in which the spouse is considered a potential suspect. Throughout the relationship, the suspected spouse is described as a violent, abusive, and controlling person who liked to keep the victim on a tight leash, yet when the victim goes missing without explanation, the spouse pretty much sits on their hands and does nothing. Here, things reach the point where Carol wrote to her parents to inform them about her relationship issues, because she was worried Eugene would listen in on her phone calls. And on the day before she vanished, Eugene showed up at Carol's workplace to start an argument, even though he had been fired from the establishment weeks earlier. That sounds like a pretty controlling and possessive spouse, yet after not seeing Carol for 3 whole days, the best he can do is leave a note? This really gives off the impression that he knew exactly what happened. If by chance, Eugene was telling the truth, Carol's actions wouldn't make any sense at all. It's unbelievable enough that someone who had such a close relationship with her family would take off without telling them, but why would she pack a suitcase full of clothing, drive her car to her parents' house, and just leave it there? Where did she go afterwards without transportation? I doubt that the Wollstonecrafts would have left the front door unlocked when they left on vacation to Colorado, so I can only assume that Carol possessed her own key to the house. It's very likely that Eugene drove Carol's car there himself, used her key to enter the residence, and then left the Wollstonecrafts a note to make himself look like the concerned boyfriend, though apparently not concerned enough to contact the police. The first time anyone really noticed that Carol was missing was when she failed to show up for her shift at Raffles Bar and Grill on the evening of August 4th, and never even bothered to call them, which sounded very uncharacteristic of her. That's why the eyewitness sighting of Carol in the car beneath the Caloosahatchee Bridge overpass is so compelling, as it took place only about 30 minutes before Carol's shift was scheduled to begin, and the woman was heard flat out telling the male driver, "Take me to work." This location was less than 4 miles from Raffles Bar and Grill, and not only did the descriptions of the man and woman resemble Eugene and Carol, but the rust-colored Mazda seemed to match the description of Carol's Mazda GLC. I know that eyewitnesses in missing persons cases are often mistaken, but this sighting does sound pretty convincing. Carol apparently told her co-workers that she was planning to break up with Eugene this very same day, and while I have no idea how these specific events would have unfolded, it's reasonable to assume that Carol may have already told Eugene she was leaving him by the time the witness saw them, and he was not reacting well. Eugene may have pretended things were okay and offered to drive Carol to work, but judging by the reaction of the woman in the passenger seat, perhaps he was taking a different route. The witness claimed that if the witness drove straight after the light changed, they would have gone down McGregor Boulevard, but the male driver made the sudden decision to cut out in front of her and head south on US Route 41. It's almost like Carol's reaction may have set Eugene off, and he decided to drive Carol somewhere in order to harm her. The only issue I have with this sighting is that on the 1-year anniversary of Carol's disappearance, the Fort Myers News Press published a news article about the case which contained this statement, quote, "The woman, after studying photographs of Wollstonecraft, later determined that it was not the missing woman she saw in the car," end quote. Well, this is the only source I've come across which mentions this detail, so I'm not sure if it's accurate, but if the woman in the rust-colored vehicle was not actually Carol, then that would be one hell of a coincidence. In fact, the first time the Fort Myers News Press reported this sighting 1 year earlier, their initial article stated that the eyewitness knew Carol personally, so this seems like an odd discrepancy. That same article also mentioned that the male driver kept trying to hide his face, so I get the impression that the witness cannot positively identify him as Eugene. Eugene's alibi that afternoon was that he was visiting relatives in Lehigh Acres, but it quickly fell apart when they denied having seen him. However, it seems apparent that at least one member of Eugene's family was complicit in what happened. As you recall, Eugene's father, Eugene LeFay Sr., told police that later that same night, both Eugene and his brother showed up at his house and demanded to borrow a shovel, as well as Eugene Sr.'s car. They then placed what he described as a quote-unquote large object in the trunk before they drove away, and given the circumstances, it's reasonable to assume they were transporting Carol's body. It's never been specified which vehicle Eugene used to arrive at his father's residence, but I have to assume it belonged to his brother. You might be wondering why they would go to the trouble of moving Carol's body between different vehicles, but I think it's worth noting that Carol's 1981 Mazda GLC hatchback was a compact model. If you look up photographs of that vehicle online, you'll notice that it has a large rear window which visibly shows the interior of a rather small trunk area as well as the back seat. In other words, this is definitely not an ideal vehicle to use if you want to transport a body. Theoretically, if the sighting of Eugene and Carol at the traffic light is legitimate, and Eugene drove off somewhere and killed her, he may have realized that it would have been difficult to conceal her body inside the Mazda, which is why he sought out the assistance of his brother. Well, it seems like an unnecessary extra step for them to transport Carol's body into their father's Buick Regal. Perhaps the brother was paranoid about leaving potential physical evidence inside his own car. We know that police questioned Eugene Sr., but it's unclear if they ever performed a forensic search of the Regal or Eugene's brother's vehicle, and I have no idea how thoroughly the brother was questioned. Like I mentioned earlier, Daphne has been unable to obtain the original case files, which is why there are some unanswered questions about this whole situation. Daphne's mother, Lori, has also said she was once told that police recovered a shovel from Eugene Sr.'s backyard, which had traces of blood and hair on it, but this detail has never been officially confirmed by law enforcement. I mean, it's been reported that Eugene washed the shovel before setting it on fire, but if it had traces of blood and hair on it, then that could have been pretty strong evidence to arrest Eugene, even without Carol's body. Of course, DNA testing was still in its infancy during the 1980s, but I'd be curious to know if there was any available evidence which could be tested today for Carol's DNA. I think the most important detail that Eugene Sr. was able to provide was the mileage on his car's odometer, as he was able to calculate that his sons drove 14 miles during the time period they were gone. Obviously, this means they could have only driven a maximum of 7 miles before they drove back to the residence, so if they were disposing of Carol's body, this at least narrows down the geographic range where she might be buried. But since Lehigh Acres is surrounded by a lot of thick wooded areas, there's no shortage of places she could be. I think now would be a good time to talk about the bizarre false lead in this case, where an anonymous so-called psychic directed police to a location where Carol's body supposedly was, but they wound up finding a deceased newborn infant. This is definitely an odd mystery within a mystery, but unfortunately, I've been unable to find out if they ever solved it or figured out who this baby's mother might have been. The child does not appear to be listed on the Doe Network, but I did find a few articles at newspapers.com which were published a few years later and confirmed that she had still not been identified. While this quote-unquote psychic claimed he got his visions crossed up, you have to wonder if he had inside knowledge about what happened to the child. Instead of coming clean and telling the truth, this person noticed Carol's disappearance in the newspapers and decided to exploit it in order to trick police into searching the area where the baby could be found. But whatever this person's intentions were, I think it's very unlikely that Carol's body was ever there. The location was over 30 miles from Lehigh Acres, and if Eugene used his father's car to dispose of Carol, he could not have driven this distance, since the odometer showed that he only traveled 14 miles. Carol's remains are probably still somewhere near the Lehigh Acres area, but while Eugene is no longer around to reveal the exact location, you have to wonder if anyone else from his family has that knowledge. While Eugene LaFace Sr. passed away in 2000, as there's actually a page for him on the Find a Grave website, but it's not clear if Eugene's brother is still around. I don't know what kind of man Eugene Sr. was, but I think it's pretty startling that his two sons essentially bullied him into borrowing his car, and that Eugene Sr. seemed genuinely afraid to speak to the police. And while there's no additional information available about Eugene's sister, it sounds like she was no princess either, since the two siblings apparently worked together to rob and stab taxi drivers in New York during the 1980s. So there are obviously some major issues within that family. Daphne has tried very hard to find out the names of Eugene's brother and sister and possibly track them down, but has not had any success, and we don't even know if they're still alive today. Since Eugene's brother was likely present when Carol was buried, he might be the only other person who knows the location of her remains. While Eugene himself will never be charged for what happened to Carol, she could still receive some form of justice if Eugene's brother is alive and could be charged for his role in helping cover the whole thing up. However, one witness told police that Eugene allegedly confessed to killing Carol and said they'd, quote-unquote, never find her, so perhaps he revealed incriminating information to other people over the years. Given Eugene's violent reputation, you can understand why they might have been reluctant to come forward, but now that he's gone, they have nothing to fear. 6 years after Carol's disappearance, Ed and Ann Wolsencroft did an interview with the Fort Myers News Press, in which they expressed their praise and gratitude towards the investigators on Carol's case, and said they had developed a close relationship with the lead detective, Richard Chard. Even though the case was not solved, it seemed like law enforcement did everything they possibly could, but just lacked that one key piece of evidence which would have allowed them to make an arrest. Indeed, when Daphne got in touch with Chard a few years ago, he told her that it was the one case he worked on during his police career which still haunts him. By this point, all Carol's family really wants to do is recover her remains and give her a proper burial, and it's possible there might be someone out there who possesses the necessary information to make that happen. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Carol Wollstonecraft, please contact the Lee County Sheriff's Office at 239-477-1000. That's 239-477-1000. But if you have anything you would like to share with her niece, Daphne, feel free to contact the Going West True Crime Podcast at their email address, goingwestpodcast@gmail.com. That's goingwestpodcast@gmail.com. I also highly recommend you check out their show, which has dropped over 100 episodes, and if you would like to learn more about them, I will be playing a promo momentarily. Also, if you would like to get in touch with me, feel free to send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the controversial 1992 death of Michelle Witherall, who supposedly fell from the third-story balcony of her apartment until her husband was accused of murdering her. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Tom N., Carl H., John M., and Katie. Thank you all so much for your support. And like I previously mentioned, here is a promo for the podcast, Going West True Crime.
What is going on, true crime fans? I'm Heath.
And I'm Daphne.
And we host a true crime podcast called Going West.
Each week, we discuss the haunting details of a different disappearance or murder case.
Like the strange and unsolved disappearance of Bryce LaPisa, who went missing under suspicious circumstances while on a road trip.
Or more recently, the murder of Janelle Matthews, which has some insane new developments.
You can stream our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Going West Pod and Instagram at Going West Podcast to check out photos from cases we cover and other news.
So for everybody out there in the world,
don't be a stranger.
I'd also like to announce that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The regular CrimeCon, which takes place at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas, from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June 12th and the 13th. And hey, Daphne and Heath from Going West True Crime, they're also planning to be there as well. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm